we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Justine Toe.
Milan Fashion Week is one of the big four fashion events of the year, along with Paris, London, and New York. And it's basically what you'd expect. Glamour, celebrities, supermodels sashaying down catwalks in impossible footwear. But last year in Milan Fashion Week, something else happened. The Green Carpet Fashion Awards were held for the first time. The organisers say these awards are unique because they're putting sustainability, arguably the most important movement for humankind, at the heart of fashion. You can watch a video of the event online. Here's one designer. She's presenting an elaborate red leather gown. That is, it looks like leather.
The material, it's an innovative solution from the food waste industry. It's made from apple skin.
From apples.
Who knew that apple skin was the future of leather?
Beautiful.
Apple skins that for real look like leather. That's just one designer. There are so many other innovations here. Buttons made from palm seeds, recycled plastic bottles turned into dresses, silk from factories that take good care of their silkworms, sequins made from old CDs. But the designers also have to demonstrate that sustainability is not just a side thing, that they're trying to move the dial in the fashion industry when it comes to sourcing and using sustainable materials.
Were you looking to do something specifically in the sustainable space?
In the Middle East, you know, we have the business of oil and the people are not aware of sustainability there. So I would love to deliver this message to the area.
The 20s and 30s who are coming through now are super interested in how they can impact saving the world.
Using sustainable materials is just one element of ethical fashion. There are other key considerations like workers' wages and factory conditions. And this was all brought into sharp focus in 2013, when more than 1,000 people died in the collapse of the eight-storey Rana Plaza in Dhaka, Bangladesh, where a number of garment factories base their operations. This building had been evacuated a day earlier when cracks had begun appearing in the walls. But, you know, as we're used to seeing new fashion arrive on our clothes racks weekly, these workers were ordered back in to complete their deadlines. It was mostly female garment workers making clothes for Western consumers who died in the Rana Plaza collapse. The tragedy, which has to be among the worst industrial accidents in history, makes clear that even though fashion, particularly fast fashion, even though fashion doesn't cost the consumer much, someone else is paying a far heavier price. But as the Green Carpet Fashion Awards make clear, there's a new consciousness around the choices consumers can make when buying clothes off the rack. In fact, an Australian organisation releases an annual ethical fashion report, which ranks or scores the ethical standards of fashion houses and businesses.
So a big part of why we put the report together was to give people a robust benchmark that they could trust. And that's been absolutely transformational in the way people shop, because they've got something there that's easy. They don't have to go scouring for the research to find out what they do.
We'll hear more from Gershon Nimbalka, Advocacy Manager at Baptist World Aid, a little later on. But first, Justine, you had a pretty intense conversation with the head of an Aussie company, Thread Harvest. What do they do?
So they call themselves an ethical fashion online marketplace, and they just won a Good Design Award for fashion design. These are pretty prestigious awards in the Australian art and design scene. The judges were particularly impressed with these impact badges that Thread Harvest created so that consumers can shop according to the values that are most important to them. So we reached out to Davin De Bruin, Managing Director at Thread Harvest, to find out more about these impact badges. They're really cool. I started out, though, by asking him how did they all get involved in ethical fashion in the first place?
We were very ignorant in the space. We started a brand and you know, we were sourcing our product and we wanted to be a profits-for-purpose organisation. And so off we went. And when we went through a business accelerator program, one of the questions were asked, how are you sourcing your product? And we said, from China, isn't that where everyone gets everything? And the questions that followed was, you know, who's making it? How's it being made? What are the labor conditions? What are the environmental aspects? And we just sat there and shrugged our shoulders. We had no idea. So that question forced us to go back to the drawing board and start from scratch and unpack this idea of ethical fashion. Because we were like, what on earth is ethical fashion? And what we discovered was actually quite shocking, really, that the fashion industry is one of the largest contributors to environmental pollution in the world. Some of the stats say second in the world next to the oil industry.
I know, I saw that. It's quite horrifying when you put it in those terms.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And then when you look further and when you look at the exploitation of men, women and children in the supply chain, when you look at human trafficking, it is also one of the greatest offenders. The stats are quite horrifying. And really, I guess our society, the culture that's been created of this need to consume at a price that's affordable, that we can continue to consume, has really forced the businesses and the organizations to go further and further and further down the supply chain to squeeze as much as they can get out so that they can turn over these products at a rapid rate and at the prices that we're seeing today.
Yeah.
And it's not only having an effect there, but it's also having effects on the local economies, because then you've got local designers and producers and artisans.
Oh, who can't compete, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
there's no ways they can compete on this level. They don't have that level of sophistication within their supply chain to be able to produce an item at the price that we see at in the different stores. So it's also kind of forcing them to go out and look for other jobs in other spaces and not be able to pursue their passions and really what they're amazing at.
Could you tell us a little bit about how Australians consume fashion then? Do we have that disposable attitude to our clothes?
We do a little bit. I mean, I think around 6,000 kilograms of waste goes into landfill every single week.
Wow.
Within Australia. It's just become part of the culture. It's part of the norm. And so we want to look, you know, fresh, and we want to look the best, and we want to be unique. And chasing after that has really resulted in us moving through our clothes at such a rapid rate without even really thinking about it.
Mm.
And so that's what the idea that we're trying to introduce is, this idea of conscious fashion, conscious consumerism. Do you know what you're doing and the effects that it's having? And it's not to lay a guilt trip on people. That's because this is the other thing that the industry has done very poorly. It's made people feel terrible about themselves. And that's not the goal. What we're trying to do is introduce an awareness. And as you introduce an awareness, I believe people naturally want to make good choices. So even though Australia has moved that way, I think as we start to see the shift within the industry happen, move towards more of this way of thinking, this idea of slow fashion, slow clothing, we start to see more and more Australians coming on board with it and advocating for it. And that's why organizations such as ours are managing to grow and take root and thrive. And it's really exciting to see. So it's looking positive.
So Thread Harvest was created in response to the economy, the industry and the culture. Two impact investors saw where the industry was headed, the rise of ethical fashion, and they found a need they could meet to give these brands exposure. And this is what Thread Harvest does. It gives ethical fashion brands a platform to share their story, express who they are, and, of course, sell their products. But the impact badge system is what Thread Harvest has become known for.
So the impact badges are simply standards that our brands strive for and achieve. Because one of the questions is, well, how do you define ethical? And everyone has a different idea. You know, my idea to ethical might be different to your idea of ethical.
Meaning that I might shop vintage and, you know, buy secondhand, whereas you're talking about fair trade conditions or...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you might shop leather and I might disagree with that because I'm vegan.
Mm.
But for you, that's okay. Whereas for me, that would be a no-no. So that's where, you know, it gets very much into the depths of who we are and our ideals and our beliefs and our values. And so our impact badge system really helped unpack just how big this word is for our customers. Because like us, we were new to it. We had no idea what ethical fashion was. And so it also helps as an education piece, as well as a process for vetting our brands. So currently we have 8 impact badges, and they include things like eco-friendly, organic, upcycled, empowering women, employing the marginalized, so on and so forth. And so for a brand to sell on our platform, they require at least 2 to 3 of these impact badges, need to be able to give evidence for it and report on it with us periodically so that we can make sure that we know what sort of impact that we're having through the sale of the various products.
How do you manage the reporting system? I mean, do they have to comply with other like independent third-party sort of certification boards? Is that how it works? And then they just report that back to you?
It varies depending on the impact badge. So for ones like the Fair Trade impact badge, there's a Fair Trade certification that you have to have. So unless you have that Fair Trade certification, you can't qualify for that badge. Organic, there's a GOT certified. There's a number of different certifications under that, but there's a GOT certification for having organic product, and you can't qualify for that unless you have that certification. Now, some of these certifications are very costly and very expensive. For some of our smaller labels who perhaps can't afford it, there needs to be an element of flexibility. So some of the impact badges don't have them. So the likes of Empowering Woman, there's not really an Empowering Woman certification that we know of yet, but we work with our brands to understand the work that they do. So Starfish Project, one of our jewelry providers, they employ people transitioning out of sex slavery and give them, because the reason they go into sex slavery is because they have no other way to, you know, provide for themselves. So they create jobs for them to be able to design the jewelry and manufacture it. And so as a result, they qualify for the Empowering Woman impact badge. And so it's about working with our brands to understand where they are. Obviously, we want to continue to push them to go for the certifications because your word is becoming less and less powerful in today's world. And we need those certifications to bring light and transparency to what it is we're doing.
The company's also working with Cornell University in the US to improve their impact badge system, because there are challenges when it comes to measuring how ethical a brand is. And then there's also the practical challenge of actually getting people to go for ethical fashion in the first place.
There's the cost factor. We're competing with other organisations, your Zara's, your H&M's, so on and so forth. So to try and continue to promote our values and, you know, apply them requires us to continue to trust that people really, really want this, and that this is something that as we make it available, people will support it. And what's been great is that we have seen that. So even though we can't compete on a price level with the likes of them, people we are finding are prepared to pay more for something that they can see how it's been created or how it's been sourced.
And this is a perfect lead into my next question. Is ethical fashion expensive? And you've just said that you can't compete with the big chains.
So I think 5 years ago, ethical fashion was very expensive. But as kind of the world, as society has moved forward and started to look at this as an area that needs to change, what we find is that organizations are investing more and more into it, suppliers are investing more and more into it, and so you have the benefit of the economies of scale. So as the demand rises, the price drops. And that's what we've seen. The conscious, should we call it, fashion industry has come so far in the last 5 years. And as it continues to develop, people are investing more and more time, effort, energy, and money into it. And as they're doing that, it's actually bringing the prices down so that these organizations, whereas maybe 5 years ago they couldn't compete, but now they can compete a lot more. So not maybe the Zara's and the H&M's, but certainly the Myers and the David Jones, we can compete on a price level. And that's really exciting to see that
absolutely.
People can support it.
And the more people do support it, the price will potentially drop even further.
This is where the industry is going, and this is why we're doing what we're doing, because we believe that we won't need to use the word ethical in the next 5 years, because that's what the fashion industry will be.
It's a bold vision. The fashion industry will just be ethical. But Davin and others are convinced that's where it's heading. And stories are an important part of keeping up the momentum. Here's Davin telling the story of a thread harvest brand.
So this is an organisation called The Giving Keys, started out in the States. And very simply put, what they do is they employ people who have been homeless and are looking for an opportunity to transition out of homelessness. The cool thing about that is that they're giving people who have been cast out by society an opportunity to create a new life for themselves and really restore dignity to them that's been robbed from them in a sense. And really that's what I think everyone's looking for. We're all looking for an opportunity to prove ourselves and showcase what we can do. And that's what I love about what the Giving Keys are doing. They're giving that to people. And so simply put, you know, they create these keys and they engrave a word onto them. And the idea is that you buy a word that you need for the season that you're in. My word has courage because I've just recently become a father. There's a long backstory to my journey and stepping out. And, you know, I worked the whole of last year salaryless looking to grow Thread Harvest. I felt it was time again to step out and do that. And having become a dad.
Yeah, wow.
You know,
yeah.
My wife on maternity leave, it required a lot of courage. So this served as kind of a reminder for why I'm doing what I'm doing. And every time I look at it, it pushes me and it reminds me that, you know, I've supported something that's bigger than me, that I've created an opportunity for someone else. Because we all just want to be believed in at the end of the day. And it's easy to say, I believe in you. But if I actually invest into you, that says it so much louder. So yeah, that's the idea behind the key. And then the cool thing is when you've achieved the word or you feel like you fulfilled it, you pass it on to someone else who needs it as kind of that tangible experience of grace, if you will, of needing a touch, of needing something to encourage and motivate and spur you on.
Yeah, wow. You mentioned grace, and there's clearly a very strong social justice component to what you're doing. Where does that come from?
For me, it's really been my faith in Jesus Christ that's led me to where I am today. I don't know if I'm sure you've picked up that I'm South African. And I moved here back in 2011, really looking for something more. You know, I had everything society said I needed to be successful. You know, I was killing it in my career. I was, you know, popular. I had friends. I had it all. I was wealthy, and yet I was just so empty inside. And I couldn't figure out what it was. So I actually came to Australia to find out, you know, maybe I need to travel. Maybe there's more for me there. And I found myself in the exact same position I was here that I was back home. I was living in Mossman, once again, earning six-figure salaries, you know, climbing the chain. I'd been sponsored on a 457 visa. Everyone wanted my life, and yet I would have given it away like that. And so I'll never forget it. It was the 10th of the first, 2012. I was sitting at my desk, and I had this thought. I was like, if this is what life is about, if this is the purpose just to exist and to gain and to get more and then do it again tomorrow, then I really don't care if I live or die. It makes no difference to me. And I remember turning to the back of my book and I just wrote there, Dear Jesus, as of today, the 10th of the first, 2012, I hand over my entire life to you. Do with it as you please. And I signed it. I didn't think much more of it. But shortly after that came the inspiration and the wisdom that I needed to turn life around. And so it became this journey of discovering who is this God that's given me life and now he's given me this whole purpose. And so for me, it's been about uncovering and understanding what that is and what my piece in this bigger picture is and how to live it out. We're all connected. At the end of the day, it really doesn't matter what you believe. In the Christian faith, we believe that you are created in the image and likeness of God, which means you have infinite value and worth. And so for us, it's to say, okay, well, how are we living that out? If someone has infinite value and worth and no one's better than anyone, then surely we should all have equal opportunity to thrive and you know, enjoy the benefits of this beautiful world that was created for us to live in. We're all interwoven and connected. And when you look at a garment, you can immediately see where there is a tear or a rip, and you're drawn to it, but you go and you repair it, right? Because you want it to continue to look good and to fit with the rest of the garment. And so for us, it's about saying, okay, there's elements and aspects of this world that's broken, and how can we go in and fix them? We've been given the skills and the abilities to do so. And so how can we go and create heaven where we see hell, so to speak. And so for us, it's in that little space in the fashion industry where we've seen it, where we feel we've been called to go in and to bring enlightenment, not to point fingers and judge, but to hopefully demonstrate that there is a better way.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Gershon Nimbalka is from Baptist World Aid, He's one of the key people putting together this resource called the Ethical Fashion Report each year. I assumed before I met him that he must have had some kind of fashion background, but actually he said there's nothing in his education or his early career that suggested this path. It was an overseas trip that he took that changed it all for him.
While I was doing that, I picked up a bit of theology, led me into a space where I went to sub-Saharan Africa and spent a few weeks just living amongst communities in slums and villages and just realised the world is really messed up and broken. And I'm mostly contributing to that rather than being part of the solution.
Gershon basically decided then and there to change his life. He wanted to be part of the solution. So how long have you been doing this, and have you seen any kind of changes happen in that time?
Yeah, it's one of the favourite questions I ever get asked. So, like, not the how long have I been doing it, because it feels like forever. That's about 9 years now. But the changes, my goodness, things have changed, which
really?
Is wonderful. 2013, we launched our first report, and at that time, the majority response from companies was, why are you asking us these questions? And why are you trying to get us to care about what happens at our fabrics or in our cotton? Like, that's outside of our scope of control and responsibility. Why would we even think about that? In the 5 years since, the vast majority of the industry have just stuck up their hand and said, yep, this is part of what we should be doing. About just under 80% of companies we research, so we research about 114, are all actively engaged in the research process. About 80% of those companies now are now tracing where their fabrics come from. About 42% are tracing where their raw materials come from. So they've made that shift. They're saying, yep, what happens to workers at every stage of our supply chain is something that we contribute to that we should make a difference on. And I see that repeat in all sorts of different campaigns. It repeats when we call the government to introduce legislation on modern slavery. I've seen at times when you've got champions in parliament, our aid volumes rise because people speak out and call for that change to happen. So my experience of advocacy is that when you've got people that are passionate, that are willing to speak out, they can achieve phenomenal things.
So tell us about the Ethical Fashion Guide. What is it? How does it work? Where do you get the information from?
Yeah, so it's a guide that grades 114 companies, about 400 brands, on the quality of the systems they have in place to ensure that workers aren't exploited. So that means that they're not enslaved, there's no child labour, and ideally that workers are being paid a living wage. And we grade companies from A to F on the strength of those systems. We look at four key areas. So what are their policies? How well do they know their suppliers and how transparent are they about it? What's the quality of their monitoring and supplier relationships, and how empowered are the workers? So that's what we look at primarily in the fashion report. This year, we started doing some preliminary work on the environment and how companies manage their environmental footprint, and that'll become an increasing part of what we grade from next year onward.
How do you get an A?
You get an A by doing all those things really well, basically. So you have strong policies, which most companies have. That's the easiest part to get right. But then you also know your suppliers from farm to factory. So you know where your raw materials like cotton is coming from. You know who your fabric suppliers are, and you know which are the factories that are producing it. And then you build relationships with those suppliers. So you can drive change within them. You can trust when they say to you that they've got good systems in place to ensure that they've got no child labour. And then you check to see that those workers are being empowered. Are there unions in place? Are there collective bargaining agreements? Are those workers being paid a living wage? So the A-plus companies, that's the sort of work that they're doing. An A company will drop off some of those things. So they may not be as strong on living wage, but they might have good collective bargaining agreements, but they'll still know most of their suppliers. We shift with the industry as well, it's probably worth noting. So it's not an absolute standard. As the industry improves, we redistribute them along basically a bell curve.
Yeah, okay.
And we do that to try to incentivize industry towards constant improvement rather than at the beginning lumping all companies down at the D&F grade,
yeah.
In which case they're just, wow, we're not going to engage with this process.
You need a bit of positive reinforcement.
Yeah, that's right.
So you do fail quite a few companies.
Yeah.
There are some Fs on that, on the guide. What kinds of things do they fail on? Are there particular things or like they're failing across the board?
Mostly it's just complete lack of transparency. So if they're not disclosing what they're doing to ensure that workers aren't being exploited, then there's no way for consumers and the public to know. So a straight fail grade usually means even if you are doing stuff, if you're not talking about it, then we can't grade you on that. We can't judge you on it because we simply don't know. So how do we work out how do we make a decision on that? There are companies that get like really bad grades, so a D minus grade, where they've started to disclose some of their systems, or they just have really bad systems. And really bad systems might just be you've got policies in place and you might have communicated that to your suppliers, but you don't even know who all your suppliers are.
I mean, I went and bought some like slippers and PJs from Cotton On last week. And so I was like, quick, look up Cotton On. And I was like, no, they do pretty well. They're like, they're an A. And often you'd kind of think that the more expensive brands would do better because, you know, they're building the kind of living wage and stuff into the prices of their products, and maybe the cheaper brands are doing worse. But it's not actually as straightforward as that, is it?
Yeah, we don't see in most cases a strong correlation between price and the quality of systems that a company has in place. Cotton On's a great example of a brand that started off with not the best grade, but have consistently invested every year to improve their systems. They've taken this very seriously. They saw that 2013 report, but also the Rana Plaza factory collapse that happened there that claimed the lives of 1,130 garment workers in Bangladesh. It shocked them, and they started to go, how do we improve our systems to make sure our workers are protected? So every year they've invested, they've traced their supply chains, they've been public about it, they've been publishing their supplier lists, they've got good monitoring, they've built supplier relationships. All that stuff is really good. Some of the more expensive brands haven't invested as heavily, or they don't have the resources to invest in heavily. Cotton On's in a great position that they're constantly growing in a tough retail space, so they have the capacity to invest in this stuff. The one question mark we have with some of those fast fashion brands is whether their business model is consistent with workers being paid a living wage. I haven't seen it happen yet. H&M and Zara, some of the biggest fast fashion brands in the world with tremendous resource, have talked about this over and over again. They haven't realized that. The only brands that we see that are paying a living wage are usually niche ethical brands that are committed to working with workers from the ground up. And you often pay more for those products as well. I think for those of us that take this stuff seriously, take whether the stuff we make is made without exploitation, and that's a primary driver for us when we're out there buying clothes, then we've got to lean towards those products that are made ethical from the ground up, show that there is interest for it, and that there are people out there that are demanding that as the first order of call rather than the cheap product. So those niche ethical brands play what I'd see as like a prophetic role to the rest of the industry to go, yeah, we're small, we don't have the economies of scale, so that makes things more expensive for us, as well as the fact that we pay more to our workers. But people are willing to pay the difference to get this done right.
It's interesting to me that you talk about, you know, we as consumers and as individuals needing to kind of change ourselves and in order to make things happen in the world, but not talking about the motivations of the companies so much. Like, do you not expect that the companies will, like, they're real people as well in these companies, that they will genuinely want to do the right thing? Will it have to be kind of economic pressure?
You get the mix. So it depends on how the company is led and who's leading it most of the time. So like Guy Rosso, who leads Kmart, now Kmart and Target, he was one of the most prominent voices after that factory collapse in Bangladesh that we just talked about, to come out and say, I had no idea it was this bad and we need to do something about it. And you note that Kmart is, again, a value brand, but they, like Cotton On, invested heavily in their system. So they've gone from a D grade to a B grade now. They haven't cracked the living wage piece. They're sort of working on it, and they've got some steps that they're taking there, but they have improved. And a lot of that has been driven by the leadership. But there are other companies that their leadership just doesn't care. So it takes the economic pressure to switch it. I won't name them here, but there's a company that I could think about that got a terrible grade, was campaigned for years, eventually put on an ethical sourcing person, sort of said, okay, this is your job to fix. And he's been using all the leverage and the campaigning from people around Australia to leverage that internally in the company and say, we need to improve this system and we need to improve this system, otherwise we'll keep copping flack. So I think it's mixed, like people, I guess. It's one of those things. Some people will take the virtuous road and other people will be pressured into it. At that point, I don't think it matters as much, as long as you get the outcome for the workers. I feel like that moment, looking out across vast slum in Tanzania when I was realizing how broken the world was and meeting people that were like forced to eat garbage, basically, because that was the only food that they could find. And they were getting sick and they were dying from it. And I just went, my heart breaks for this. And I think that was a reflection of what I believe to be God's heart. Like, there's this profound sense that God feels all this as deeply, if not more deeply, than I ever could. And he wants all those people to be engaged with the journey to make that change. And every one of us can have a part of that. And I don't know, like, his desire for that isn't just for the Christians, those that are already following him, it's for everyone. And I see people at different spots of the journey doing that now. So my faith has certainly crystallized for me the things that are really important. That commitment to make the world better, to make it just, that commitment to that love is the supreme virtue, that love transcends boundaries. It's not just limited to my family and friends, but extends to wherever in the world that there is need. And I think that constant reflection and that connection with God reminds me of why I do what I do.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Justine Toe and Natasha Moore.
You can find and share episodes of Life and Faith on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on your podcast app. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us.
If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating or review. It helps us and helps other people discover our show.
Next week.
Sometimes people would do what we would call Miss World prayers. Oh, yeah, guys. And they'd be a bit drunk, you know. Oh, yeah, guys. I just want you to pray for world peace. Just bless the world. And then we'd say, okay, we'll do that. And I'd say, God, pray for, like, say the guy's name was Bob. You know, I pray for Bob. I pray that he would see world peace. And then Bob would say, actually, I've got a few other things I'd like you to pray about.
Yeah.
And so I think once they realised that we weren't just messing about, that we were serious, that we didn't mind praying for anything, then you'd almost like go two rounds. First round would be a bit surface, second round a little bit deeper.